What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today, we are going to talk about weight loss medications. I've been making notes for this podcast all week, kind of toying with how much of a deep dive this is going to be. Is this going to be a deep dive? Is this going to be weight loss, you know, weight loss drugs for dummies? Is this going to be weight loss drugs one-on-one? It's going to be a bit of both. I'm not going to go so deep into the weeds that it becomes something that's very technical and hard to understand. I definitely want to err on the more applicable information side of things, more on the, you know, GLP-1 for dummies, more on the, you know, GLP-1 101 side of things. But, you know, if I find myself, you know, going down a route that I think is interesting, I will let that happen. My notes are extensive. I'll try and keep it. I want this to be applicable. I want people to be able to listen to this podcast, and it is my hope that you listen to this podcast and you have a good understanding of what these drugs are, who they're for, and you know, either whether or not they're something that's right for you or just a better understanding of them because they're not going anywhere. So quick table of contents before we get into it. We're going to talk about what is GLP-1 and how is it normally produced. We'll talk about a brief history of GLP-1s, how long have these drugs been around. I think it's pretty interesting history, just kind of how we discovered these and how they've progressed. The distinction between treatment for obesity and diabetes. This podcast will primarily, if not solely, talk about the treatment of obesity, but we'll talk about that distinction. Which drugs are currently available / coming soon? What's in the pipeline? Generally, how do they work? And specifically, how do they work? Talk about how much weight are people actually losing on these drugs? Side effects, common misconceptions, who should and shouldn't take them, how to make the most of the drug, do you need to take them forever, and essentially how to get the drug or these drugs. So that's a little table of contents. If you're interested, we're going to go in that order. And before we even start, I think whatever you think about these drugs, they are here, they're not going anywhere, and we are only going to progress from here. This is not like a thing where these are going anywhere. And so even if you have a preconceived opinion on them, learning more about them should be something you do because they are not going anywhere. And personally, I find it's my responsibility as a coach, as somebody who's going to work with people on these drugs, to learn as much as I can, be a subject matter expert, a resource for people to figure out how to help people use them for good, right? Use them in the best way possible. So let's start with, what is GLP-1 and how is it normally produced? GLP-1 is a hormone that your body already makes. So when people are like, oh, these are GLP-1 medications, this is some, you know, I'm taking this hormone. It's something your body already makes. I don't know if that, you know, triggers people to think that they're more or less safe, but I think it's just an interesting point. GLP-1 is a hormone produced by what are called your L cells, which are found primarily in the lower intestine and colon. You have a lot of hormones that are produced within the digestion process at different points along your digestive tract that communicate to your body that nutrients are present. And some of those, you know, we'll talk more about this later, but they communicate with the brain and tell you that you're full and that certain nutrients are present. And so GLP-1 is one of those hormones produced in the lower intestine and the colon. And these cells release GLP-1 in response to food intake, particularly when nutrients like carbs and fats reach the intestine. And what GLP-1 does is it stimulates an insulin release, which is hysterical for people that still think insulin somehow blocks fat burning because GLP-1 medications literally stimulate insulin release. They slow down gastric emptying, which is the rate at which food leaves your stomach, which helps control appetite and food intake, which we'll talk a lot more about in a bit. And promotes feelings of fullness and reduces hunger. And that's what GLP already is doing in your body. That's already happening. When you eat food, the food reaches the lower intestine and the colon, these cells release GLP-1, and that communicates with your body to stimulate an insulin release and slow down gastric emptying and communicate with the brain that you have food in you so that you can, you know, feel more full and satiated. The problem with what we'll call native GLP-1 or the GLP-1 that your body breaks, that your body produces naturally, is it breaks down super quickly in just a few minutes. But we'll get to that. Now, a brief history of GLP-1s, how long these drugs have been around, how they kind of first were discovered, let's say. I will say that this is just something that I find interesting. It's not necessarily like super pertinent to today, but I think it's interesting. So here we go. We learned about GLP-1s in the 80s, mostly in the context of its ability to stimulate insulin, like we talked about. The problem was natural GLP-1 breaks down super quickly in minutes, which makes it impractical as a medication. You can't just give GLP-1 because our body breaks it down very quickly. It doesn't last long enough in the body to be practical as a use of medication. In the late 80s, early 90s, this dude, John Ang, is studying peptide hormones in animal venoms, like duh, like total normal job. You know, which is, it's got, if the animal venoms have actually led to other medical discoveries, so it's not the weirdest thing in the world. But he was studying the Gila monster, and the Gila monster was of particular interest because it only eats like 3 or 4 times per year. So they were like, oh, maybe something cool is going on here with the Gila monster. We can learn about its venom, etc. When this guy, John Ang, analyzed the venom, he isolated a peptide. It's called Exendin 4, whatever. And it's very similar to the makeup of human GLP-1, except for one key difference. It's much more stable in the body. While natural human GLP-1 breaks down in minutes, this Exendin 4, which basically acts like human GLP-1, could last for hours. And that's, you know, important for the Gila monster, likely evolved in some way to help the lizard digest its very infrequent meals. It eats very infrequently. We said 3 or 4 large meals per year. Right, so this would help slow down gastric emptying, allow the lizard to control its blood sugar, and extract more nutrients. This guy, Ang, essentially went on to patent this discovery in 1996, right, which just, again, highlights how long we've known about GLP-1 and the potential for it to be used as a medication. And this eventually led to the development of exenatide, which was, let's call it, the first GLP-1 medication, brand name Byetta, which became the first GLP-1 receptor agonist approved for treating diabetes. The medication was literally a synthetic version of this lizard venom compound. Like, super duper interesting history of just how these drugs came about. Just absolutely fascinating. From here, from 1996, I'm going to fast forward to the introduction of semaglutide in 2017, since that's where most people pick up this story, right? That's where most people's, in modern times, have their first relationship. And I know that There are drugs, and I'll talk about them very briefly, that were around before semaglutide, right? In between 1996 and 2017, there are several drugs, several GLP-1 receptor agonists that have been used. But again, most people are coming here with, like, you know, Ozempic being their first introduction to semaglutide in 2017, right? But I just wanted to highlight, we've known about these and have had several drugs for over 20 years. You know, so people who are like, we don't know anything about these drugs long-term, or these drugs have been around for 20 plus years. But again, we'll talk about that a bit more. So, quick distinction between the treatment of obesity and diabetes. You're going to hear a lot of different words. If you're just like listening to commercials on the internet or stuff online, you'll hear a lot of different names. And so the name of the drug or active ingredient is sometimes or always different than the brand name for the treatment that it's indicated for. So you have semaglutide, which is the name of the drug. But then when it gets indicated for the treatment of a disease, they give it a brand name. So the brand name for the treatment of diabetes is Ozempic. So Ozempic is semaglutide for the treatment of diabetes. And then you have Wegovy. Wegovy is semaglutide for the treatment of diabetes. And they have slightly different dosing protocols. But if somebody's taking Ozempic or they're taking Wegovy, it's the same thing. They're taking semaglutide. And similarly, the more recent drug is called tirzepatide. And that is the name of the drug. But the brand name for the treatment of diabetes is Mounjaro. And the brand name for the treatment of obesity is Zepbound. And so if somebody's taking Zepbound or Mounjaro, they're taking the same thing, but for a slightly different purpose. They're both taking tirzepatide. One is indicated for the treatment of obesity, the other one indicated for diabetes. They have slightly different dosing protocols, but they're the same drug, essentially. Now, I'm going to be discussing the treatment of obesity for the remainder of this podcast. I will not use Ozempic or Mounjaro. I will either reference the brand name Wegovy or Zepbound, or I'll reference the name of the drug itself, semaglutide or tirzepatide. And you're going to hear a lot of these names, and as much as I think becoming somewhat familiar with these drugs is helpful, I will say that it can be a little bit overwhelming to try and remember all of these names. You don't necessarily need to know that. I'll try and, at the end of the podcast, give you 10 points to remember to take home from this podcast. So I appreciate you following along with each section, and I'll try and give you a nice little summary at the end. So which drugs are currently available / coming soon? Different drugs. Let me start with this. Different drugs combining different hormones and basically acting on different pathways. So different drugs combine different hormones and act on different pathways. And we're not going to dive into the physiological differences of each of them today, But it's important to know that on some level, like, the race is on. The race for better and better and better drugs is on. We have many new drugs that act in a similar way in the pipeline coming over the next 5 to 10 years. And they're all a little bit different. Remember, we said that there are other hormones produced in the gut, not just GLP-1. There are other ones, other hormones that affect satiety and help us eat less, which we'll get into in a second. But just to have a baseline understanding of this, semaglutide or Wegovy is just GLP-1. It's just a GLP-1 agonist. It acts like GLP-1 in the body. It is one thing. Tirzepatide or Zepbound is GLP-1, so it's semaglutide, plus GIP, which is another hormone. Essentially, tirzepatide is two things, semaglutide is one thing. And we'll get into this in a second, but tirzepatide is better than semaglutide in every way. Next, we have two more drugs that I think you should know the name of, because we're going to be learning a lot more about them over the next, you know, couple of years. One is retatrutide, which is GLP-1 plus GIP, so same as tirzepatide, plus one more hormone called glucagon. And so this is three things, right? Semaglutide was one thing, tirzepatide was two things, retatrutide is three things. And then we have another drug that's, again, being studied currently called CagriSema, which is GLP-1 plus amylin. And again, I'm not going to go into exactly why drug X is outperforming drug Y or exactly how the addition of a certain hormone is physiologically aiding in the performance of these drugs. I'll share some weight loss statistics and I'll talk about, you know, how these drugs compare to one another. But I think, again, the thing I would understand here is that the race for the best drug is upon us. Each new drug seems to work better and better. And this is just the beginning. And that sounds like an emotive, something with like an emotional backing, a comment with an emotional backing. All I'm saying is that is a fact. We are seeing with each new drug, more weight loss, more sustained weight loss, higher percentage of people reaching certain thresholds, and less side effects. So better results and less side effects. So, and we're going to get into both of those things a bit more in a bit. So very generally speaking, how do they work? Well, they do not directly cause fat loss, right? Like, it's not like you take one of these drugs and it is just by itself going to melt fat off your body, right? It does not increase lipolysis to a meaningful way. It's not making you move more, right? And there are some things about retatrutide, which is a drug that's coming in the next few years that might be playing on the energy expenditure side of things. But for now, let's park that. Essentially, very simply, these drugs make you feel more full, more satiated, which gives you the power to eat less calories. And all of the weight loss that we see in the research can be explained by a reduction in calorie intake. For all the like people who think carbs make you fat or insulin makes you fat or this makes you fat, like, these drugs just put all of that stuff to bed. The amount of weight that people lost was directly, mathematically, exactly because of a reduction in calorie intake. Now, you might be asking, specifically, how do they make you eat less? How are they making you feel more satiated? And you might not care. You might be like, oh, that's not really important to me. I don't care about these like underlying mechanisms, but I do think that they're kind of interesting. So I won't spend too long on it, but I think it is interesting. I would break this down in basically how they're making you eat less into three categories. The first is a central effect on appetite in the brain. And again, we talked about GLP-1. One of the things that GLP-1 does is it signals to your brain that nutrients are present, right? And so it tells your body that you have eaten food, and that impacts appetite. So it's essentially it's just directly affecting appetite sensing in the brain. The second is it slows gastric emptying. So it's slowing the rate of food leaving the stomach, making you feel more like physically full for longer, right? It makes you feel more full more quickly and make you feel more full longer. Like, okay, I have a central effect on appetite in the brain, and this food is staying in my stomach longer, right? It's kind of clear how those things might make you feel more satiated on average. And the third is what we kind of will colloquially call a reduction in food noise. And this one sounds vague, right? Like, food noise is almost like a modern term that we've coined, right? What does that really mean? Well, it implies some sort of action on the dopamine or opioid system, your reward system. What we see with these drugs is it reduces the rewarding nature of palatable foods, Right? When you eat, when you eat yummy food, there is some reward response in the brain, and these drugs seem to dampen that reward response. And we see that manifest in a couple of ways. We'll talk about my experience with clients, kind of how that manifests. But we are seeing anecdotally that these drugs make people drink less alcohol, smoke less, do less recreational drugs. Things that normally would have been, you know, dopamine-seeking behaviors are dampened. We also see a reduction in taste scores. So people that, you know, will eat a meal and before they were on the drug, they rated this meal as a, you know, 9 out of 10 in terms of taste. On the drug, those taste scores come down. And I find this one to be fascinating. It just makes food less rewarding. It makes food less stimulating to your reward center of like, oh my God, I loved this food. I need more of it. I need to keep eating it. It dampens those feelings, which is super duper powerful. So in summary, GLP-1s keep food in the gut longer, probably sending a direct signal of fullness in the brain, along with making tasty foods less tasty, so people don't want to eat them as often, and that's it. They eat less calories, right? And to kind of reference some of the differences in those drugs that we talked about before, the introduction or the effect of other hormones like GIP and glucagon on top of GLP-1 aren't fully understood yet. And that's not me not understanding it. This is the regurgitation of experts in the field that are like, yeah, we have an idea of maybe what's happening, but why the addition of GIP and glucagon are making these drugs even better is not really 100% fully understood yet. And so looking forward to learning a bit more about that. Now, my experience with clients, because for the last 3 years or so, I've had clients that have been on these drugs, we'll say. And some of the things that I wanted to share, I was like, hey, what are some of the things that have really struck me as interesting with clients? The first is people who have, again, previously been obsessed with food, 24/7 thinking about food, have had experiences where they forgot to eat, right? I'm not saying forgetting to eat. I'm not glorifying that. I'm not saying, oh, forgetting to eat is really awesome. But like for somebody who's struggled with obesity, who has tried lifestyle a lot, who's worked with a coach for a long time, nutritionists, dietitians, physicians, whatever, for that person to go from 24/7 food noise to forgetting to eat is just a crazy thing that when this happens to clients, so I'll get on a call and they're like, honestly, for the first time in my life, I was at work and I forgot to eat my lunch or something, whatever, right? So insert some scenario like that. That is just, to me, such an interesting manifestation of what these drugs do is they just dampen the reward center and obviously make you feel more full. And for a person who's been food focused 24/7 for their whole life, forgetting to eat a meal is like, holy crap, I never thought that that would happen. Other experiences are people reporting being able to stop eating a meal when they're out, like a restaurant meal. I will say, even just most people listening to this will say, you know, when I go out to a restaurant and I order a yummy meal, on average, I tend to finish that thing, right? I tend to finish the meal. It's rare that I go out to a nice restaurant, order a really yummy meal, and voluntarily stop eating because I'm good, I'm satiated. And that just, on average, that doesn't happen to most people. And specifically for people with, let's say, dysregulated appetite and heightened reward to food, that never happens. But I have clients all the time that are like, yeah, I went to brunch and I got this, you know, kind of yummy meal, but you know, 3/4 of the way through, I said, you know what, I'm good. And I put the fork down and I stopped eating. For somebody who's struggled with appetite for their whole life, that is such an unbelievably powerful experience. Another one is, some of these are direct quotes. I get to decide if I have another cookie or not. That one has always stuck with me, where it's like the idea that you could have one cookie and actually feel satisfied with that one cookie and not have that kind of food noise screaming at you to go get another one. And this comes back to, you know, people are like, obesity is a choice. Obesity is a choice. It's like, yeah, but you don't understand the volume of food noise for different individuals and how difficult that air quote decision can be in many contexts. And so this kind of dampening of the reward of certain foods gave this person the power to decide whether or not he or she wanted to have another cookie in that moment. Whereas normally they might have felt just so powerfully compelled to have another cookie. And so I'll get in a second to something I want to say, but I just find that so powerful. Two more is that I've had clients this happens many times, that say they food shop differently, that they walk around the supermarket and they, that voice in their head that compels them to grab X or Y off the shelf, I need this, I need that, I need this snack, I need that snack. They say, I feel like I walk around the supermarket and I just don't have that voice. I'm able to think about what sorts of foods fit my goals without that voice turned up to an 11 saying, you need this snack, this sounds yummy, this sounds tasty, you'll like this, this is a great snack. They're able to go to the supermarket and food shop differently. I absolutely love that because frankly, food shopping is like the first step to eating a food, right? It's like buying the food, it being in your house, and then you facing it in your house with enough frequency where eventually it gets eaten. And so if you can food shop differently, then you probably increase the likelihood of eating the things you buy, duh. And so if you can food shop more nutritious foods on average, that's a good thing. And then plenty of clients, honestly, almost all of them report drinking less alcohol. Where they might have been a 2 or 3 drink person at dinner, 1 drink max. Just that drive to drink goes down. It's amazing. And that obviously independent of weight loss is really great. Now, let's talk about how much weight are people losing. I'm going to go through a chart here. I'm going to try and keep it to the important stuff. We are going to discuss weight loss as a percentage of starting body weight, right? And we're doing that because that is how it is discussed in the literature when it comes to the health benefits of weight loss. We talk about, hey, how much weight does somebody need to lose to see, you know, maybe diabetes remission or improvements in blood pressure and all of these other things. It's always discussed in a percentage of body weight because you can't just say, oh, well, they have to lose 30 pounds. It's like, well, that's different for someone who's 400 pounds as somebody who's 200 pounds. So percentage of body weight is a much more appropriate way of discussing the potential benefits of weight loss. And to give you guys some parameters, 10% weight loss is where we start to see a large percentage of the health benefits, right? Things like reductions in A1C and cholesterol and improvements in blood pressure and fasting glucose and insulin and all that stuff, markers of metabolic health. And at about 15% weight loss is where we get almost, if not all, of the benefits of weight loss. So those markers are really important. Can we get people to lose 10% of their body weight? Can we get people to get to 15% of their body weight? It's possible that more weight loss still can help some people, but if we're in a clinical setting treating people with obesity, we want them to get to a place where they're getting a large, if not all of the benefit of weight loss, we're aiming for that at least 10%, you know, really would be great to shoot for that 15%. So I want you to remember those numbers, 10% weight loss, 15% weight loss. And there's a nice little chart put together by Lyle McDonald in his book, and it goes over the 4 drugs, liraglutide, which is the drug that was out most recently before semaglutide. So in the order of the chronological order of releasing these drugs, we have liraglutide is the oldest, then semaglutide, which is Wegovy or Ozempic. Then we have tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro and Zepbound. And then we have retatrutide, which is not out yet, but we have enough research on it, and the numbers are staggering. So let's look at that 10% weight loss. What percentage of people in the research lose more than 10% of their body weight? Because that's kind of a nice demarcation, a nice threshold that we want to get people to. With liraglutide, which is our oldest medication, 1/3 of the people who took it in the research lost over 10% of their body weight. And at the time, that was incredible. 1/3 of people are going to get just way healthier. And 18% of people lost over 15%. So let's say 1 in 5 people lost over 15% and 1 in 3 people lost over 10%. The majority of people over 50% lost over 5%, whatever. We're not going to do the less numbers for a second. It will be here all day. This is a big graph. Going from liraglutide to semaglutide, I just want to talk about this here. Liraglutide, 1/3 of the people who took liraglutide lost over 10%. When we would go to semaglutide, which is Wegovy, 70% of people who took the drug lost over 10% of their body weight. That is a 300-pound person losing 30 pounds, a 200-pound person losing 20 pounds, and so on. Liraglutide, again, the oldest medication, 18% of people lost over 15%. Again, over 15% is where we are. We're flying. We're killing it. 18% on liraglutide, 50% on semaglutide. I just want you to just understand how much better these drugs are getting. Not only did 50% of people lose over 15% on semaglutide or Wegovy, but 1/3 of people lost over 20%, right? That's 20% weight loss is crazy. That's a 200-pound person losing 40 pounds. It's a 300-pound person losing 60 pounds. That's crazy. Now, from semaglutide, which is Wegovy, to tirzepatide. Right? Semaglutide, 70% of people lost over 10% of their weight. On tirzepatide, 83% of people, up to 83% of people lost over 10%. That's like, you know, virtually everyone, 4 out of 5 people lost over 10%. And 50% of people on semaglutide lost over 15%, up to 70% of people on tirzepatide, Mounjaro, Zepbound, lost over 15% of their body weight. It keeps going. Semaglutide, Wegovy, had 30% or 1 in 3 people lose over 20%. Tirzepatide, up to 56% of people lost over 20% of their body weight. Now, on Wegovy or semaglutide, nobody lost more than 25% or a very small percentage of people. On Zepbound or tirzepatide, up to a third of people lost over 1/4 of their body weight. It's bananas. That's like a 320-pound person losing 80 pounds. It's crazy. And so I'm going to pause for a second. Right now, semaglutide, Wegovy, and tirzepatide, Zepbound, are the two drugs that are on the market right now that people are really like interested in. And I just want to say, Zepbound is better in every way. More people lose more weight with less side effects. And I'll make a case for how to go about navigating what will ultimately become a landscape of many options. But I will start by saying, if you're interested in these drugs, you should be interested in Zepbound. You should be interested in the drug that works better with less side effects. Now, retadrutide is not yet out. You can't get FDA approved retadrutide. It's not FDA approved for the treatment of obesity, but I want to throw some numbers at you. I'm going to just start with the 15%. There are some studies where 83% of people on retadrutide lost over 15%. Again, these are ranges, so I'm giving you the most favorable numbers just to kind of blow your mind on where these drugs are headed. Up to 70%. Again, not everyone, not every study. It's a range, but up to 70% of people lost over 20%. Up to 50% lost over 25%. And up to 1/4 of the people lost over 30% of their body weight on retadrutide. That is insane. And again, my thoughts on all of this are that each new drug is getting better. We are in the rat race for the best drug. And these, you know, biotech companies are working hard to outperform each other. And so far, liraglutide to semaglutide, huge jump. Semaglutide to tirzepatide, big jump. Tirzepatide to retadrutide, big jump. And again, we are just at the beginning of this stuff. Also, other thoughts, higher doses perform better on average, but some people do really well on low doses. Within all of these statistics, I want to be very clear, there's a lot of individuality, right? These are averages. So we have people who lose a little less, we have people that lose a little bit more. There is definitely some individuality. On average, women seem to lose more weight. I would hypothesize that that's because these are fixed doses. Women are not on lower doses, right? And so on average, women will weigh less. And so on average, they're taking relatively more medication. Does that make sense? There's a fixed dosage. And if women are smaller on average, that means relatively they're taking more drug or just like more of the drug. So I wouldn't be surprised if that basically explained the reason why women seem to lose more. But again, each new drug seems to be getting better. Higher doses perform better on average, but some people do really well on low doses, which is one of the reasons incrementally, like a step increase in dosing is smart. Let's talk about side effects. Let's talk about side effects here. I want to start with this here. All drugs have potential side effects. All drugs, anything you put in your body has a potential for a negative side effect. There is no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as there's only upside, right? You take a drug because the benefits outweigh the potential side effects, the potential risks. Now, the big side effect, the big bucket of side effects are under the umbrella of, let's call it GI discomfort. Nausea, vomiting, constipation, diarrhea, which is kind of ironic how both of those can happen, constipation and diarrhea. And they get better over time. I don't know exactly at what point. I think it's after about 20 weeks, we see on average in the research, a big decline in people saying that they have these symptoms. I will also say that on tirzepatide and retatrutide, the amount of people saying that they had these symptoms is much lower. So again, if you have the power, the means to, and you want to go on one of these drugs, I recommend you go on Zepbound. It is more powerful for weight loss and has less side effects. Retatrutide seems to be even better and less side effects. But yeah, okay, if you just looked at Wegovy obviously also people do wonderfully with that. Now, there are going to be people who are sounding an alarm about some really scary side effects. Thyroid issues, pancreatitis, gallbladder issues. All of these are incredibly small. 1% of people that take these drugs experience some other side effect like this. So you might hear that and you're like, oh, he's downplaying these serious things. No, all drugs have side effects. Every drug that's out there that you take, every supplement out there that you take has downsides, has side effects. So I am personally not alarmed that there is a tiny, tiny percent of something happening, because that just kind of makes sense with drugs. And so anyway, talk to your doctor. I'm not your doctor. You decide how you feel about these risks. I'm telling you that there is a small percentage, about 1% of people report some other thing happening. And the last note on side effects, the risks and the side effects seem to all be worse with older drugs and less bad or better with the newer ones. It's like with every drug, we're finding a way to get more weight loss and less side effects, which is great. I mean, that would be by all accounts a better medication. Let's go through some common misconceptions. What do we have? I have three of them. The first is that these drugs cause muscle loss. You've heard people like Peter Attia, I'm not shitting on Peter at all. I'm just saying there's a clip of Peter Attia who a lot of people know, kind of fear-mongering about muscle loss, and you know, people lose all this muscle and they don't get healthier because they lose all this lean mass, which is really important for health. I want to be very, very clear when I say this. These drugs do not cause muscle loss. What causes muscle loss is that people eat extremely low calories, do not resistance train, and don't eat enough protein. These drugs don't do anything but make you eat less food. They're not actively reducing muscle mass. They're not actively causing fat loss. They're making you eat less food. And so if you want to not lose muscle, lift weights and eat enough protein. Period. Right? There's the fear-mongering I see, and I think that clip by Peter is pretty old, so I suspect that his views have changed a little bit. I think that was early on with some of the research. Usually the people that are fear-mongering about muscle loss are somehow feel threatened by these drugs. I've seen it. I've seen it with like Mark Hyman's content. It's just screaming insecurity. It's like, oh, these people who are going to take these drugs won't need my stupid supplements anymore or something like that. It's like the fear that people will be put out of business by these drugs. They will over-index this fear of muscle loss or this expectation or this realization of muscle loss. Here's the deal. We'll talk about how to maximize the use of these drugs in a later chapter in a couple, you know, whatever, in 10 minutes or something. But these drugs don't cause muscle loss. What causes muscle loss is eating incredibly low amount of calories, not resistance training, and not eating enough protein. And so, yeah, if you want to maintain muscle mass, obviously the eating low calorie part is part of your plan. Do the other two. Eat enough protein and resistance train. And you really, if you do those things, you don't have anything to worry about in terms of, you know, muscle loss that's going to cause an issue. You don't. The next misconception is that these drugs, and this is going to be a contentious one, I think, is that these drugs are cheating, or that these drugs are being taken instead of focusing on lifestyle. I want to give you an example. First of all, these drugs are not cheating for the people that need them, right? They are not cheating for the people that need them. The people that need them have struggled with obesity for a long time. We'll talk about who should take this drug, but there are people that have genetic predispositions for obesity. And I want to give you an example. There is a gene called the APOE4 gene. I won't bore you with it, but you can have certain copies of certain variants of this gene. And a certain combination of certain gene variants, it's called the APOE4. If you are APOE4 homozygous, which means you have two APOE4 alleles, you are at a much greater risk of Alzheimer's disease and cardiovascular disease. Do you know how I know that? Because I am an APOE4. It affects like 1% of the population. I am APOE4 homozygous. And one of the things that that means, yes, I'm 15 times more likely to get Alzheimer's. I'm, 10 to 12 times more likely to get cardiovascular disease. But one of the things that it means is that I will have genetically, on average, genetically higher LDL and APOB. So we think of cholesterol, ApoB, LDL, we think of that as something that's modifiable by lifestyle, right? Don't eat too much saturated fat, eat enough fiber, exercise, eat polyunsaturated fats, filter your coffee, whatever. All of the things that you can do to bring down cholesterol, don't have too much body fat, all that stuff. It is modifiable by lifestyle. However, I will always have higher LDL than somebody who's not an ApoE4 homozygous. My dad is quite in shape, not overweight. He's in decent shape, eats very nutritious diet, and his LDL is still over the reference range, and he requires medication. You know why he requires medication? Because he has a genetic disadvantage here. And I want to be very clear. It is the same for people with obesity. I'm sorry if people don't understand what I'm about to say, but we, as individuals, some of us get more full from meals than others. We take 1,000 people, we give them the same meal that's in the same ratio to their total intake, and some people feel more full than others. Some people feel more hungry after than others. Some people have a heightened reward response in the brain to food than others, right? We talked about that, this effect on the opioid or dopamine receptors, or the dopamine slash opioid system, we'll call it. People are like, everyone's like, some people like food more than others. And then other people will say, that's not true. I love food and I'm in great shape. And I'll tell you what, I am a person who I claim to love food. I do love food. However, clearly, I have a lower reward response in the brain to food than others. And this has been studied. This isn't like a thing we've made up. We've studied all this. Some people get more full than others. They produce more native GLP-1. They produce more of these hormones that help them get full after a meal than other people. Some people produce less of these hormones. They are less sensitive to these hormones. They have a heightened response to food in the brain, and they have a higher baseline hunger. Like, the heritability or the amount that we can attribute to genetics of obesity is like 40 to 70%. We have identified genes that predispose people to obesity, and they have to do with satiety, reward, baseline hunger, and all of that still misses other social determinants of health, irrespective of genetics. There are plenty of other things that predispose somebody to let's say, greater adiposity or having more body fat. These drugs level the playing field for people who need them. They help people who have appetite dysregulation regulate their hunger. And I want to be very clear. It's something I highlighted and bolded it. I have never struggled with my weight, and I might never be able to actually feel what somebody with those, let's say, less than favorable genetics feels like, right? I won't be able to actually feel the food noise that somebody with obesity feels, right? But, here's where I feel so strongly. When I hear people describe how they feel on the drug, and I have goosebumps, I swear to God, I have goosebumps, and I could get emotional about this, but when I hear what people describe as their experience on the drug, it sounds like how I've lived my whole life. If you kind of cast your mind back 15 minutes ago and we talked about my experience with clients who were like, I was able to stop before I had a second cookie. I was able to walk through the supermarket without needing to put everything in my cart because it all looked yummy. I was able to stop eating a restaurant meal even though I thought it was yummy because I felt myself getting full. I've lived my whole life that way. And so when I see what these drugs can do for people that struggle like that, I see it as a leveling of the playing field for people who need it. And I'm sorry about the F-bomb. Just a big fuck you to people who say that obesity is a choice. That's so disingenuous to the complexity of obesity as a chronic disease. These drugs level the playing field for those who need it. Right? That second part is something we're going to talk about. Who needs it? Who should take it? But when I hear people describe what their experience is like on the drug, it's how I've lived my whole life. Or I nod. It's so funny because when somebody is describing to me how much food noise they have and how uncontrollable that food noise is, I can sympathize because I've worked with these people my whole life, and it's my life's work to help people get healthy. But I don't actually know that feeling. But when people are on the drug and they're explaining to me the new, what feels like willpower that they have, I know exactly what they mean. And in my heart, I know that this is giving them the tools to that I've always had. And so that's just something that I feel strongly I really wanted to say. Alrighty, who should take these drugs and who shouldn't? I'm going to try and keep this to an hour. We got 20 minutes. We have quite a bit to get through. So let's get to some of these things that I know people are really thinking about. Who should and shouldn't take them? If not for shortage issues, I wouldn't give a shit what an adult with a fully formed brain does with all the information, right? If it wasn't for certain issues, if Jack or Karen, you know, want to lose a couple pounds for summer and they want to take this medication and they fully understand the risks, on some level, I don't care. You can go ahead and do that. I don't care. The problem is that these things don't happen in a vacuum and they affect others, and we'll get to that in a second. So who should consider who are these drugs potentially for? They're for people with obesity who have tried and are continuing to work on lifestyle for whom weight loss will in all likelihood improve health, right? They are people who have and are continuing to work on lifestyle for whom weight loss will in all likelihood improve their health. If that's not you, it's my current stance that it is not worth the risk. I mean, why take a medication that is not going to make you healthier that has some risk attached to it, right? Who probably shouldn't take this medication? Everyone else. While the drugs are relatively safe and we have 3+ year studies on them, we don't have 30-year studies on them. So if taking the drug doesn't make you healthier, all you're doing is incurring potential risk. Again, normally I wouldn't care what people do with their, like I wouldn't care if Karen or John want to take this drug just to lose some weight before summer. However, there are two problems with that. Number one, if a lot of people do that, which they are, there are shortages for people that actually need the drug. And I've seen that with every single client at some point that I've worked with has had some sort of challenge getting the drug. And that is down to a couple of things, insurance, cost, but also a shortage because people who don't need them are, you know, mopping them up. The second issue that I don't think people are talking about enough is people who don't need them taking them reinforces and furthers completely unrealistic body standards of thinness that affect our mental and physical health as a society. We push the baseline obsession with thinness even further, right? This is for people with obesity who have struggled their whole life to improve their health. It's not for thin people to get even thinner. And I think if that furthering of these unrealistic body standards is something that people aren't talking about, of like, we're already kind of screwed in this age of AI and social media, but now you have people who are already lean and healthy getting leaner and just furthering this unrealistic thinness body standard, which just is not helping our mental and physical health. Now, how do you make the most of the drug if you're going to be on it? Assuming you're somebody who can benefit from it, should take it, how do you make the most of the drug? I want to be clear. Do not let the drug do the work. These drugs should be helping you do the work. Right? The point is to help you make lifestyle changes, not instead of lifestyle changes. And I want to make a point here. When I was reading out those how much weight people were losing, and I was like, oh, these people lost this percentage. The people in these studies, I want to be clear, this is a point that I feel like also is under-discussed. The people in those studies, they were not given the drug and told to go on their merry way. The way people are using these drugs is they're just injecting themselves with the drugs and that's it. And they're like, cool, I'll be more full and I'll eat less. But they're not using the drug as a means to change their lifestyle. They're using the drug and hoping that without any intent on changing lifestyle, the drug will just do the work. And that's not what people in the studies were doing. People in the studies were given nutrition guidelines. They were given monthly consultations. They were given activity guidelines. They were people that were actively trying to improve their lifestyle. So when you hear those numbers of how well these drugs do, that is in people with obesity who are actively trying to improve their lifestyle. Now, do I think those interventions are amazing? No, I think working together one-on-one with a coach, which we'll talk about, some sort of person to be by your side is better. But if you take this drug and you do nothing but take the drug and hope that it makes you so full you eat less, You will not see the results that we see in the research. That is just not how that works. You need to also be trying to change your lifestyle. And of course, we'll talk about how that would behoove you long-term. Additionally, you should work with a doctor to get up-to-date blood work, especially if you're on any medications, because as you lose weight, specifically people who lose a lot of weight very quickly, you'll need to titrate the dosing of the weight that you're losing. You know, we see people with on either lipid-lowering medication or more specifically blood glucose-lowering medications. They lose a lot of weight, and all of a sudden, they go hypoglycemic because their medication dosing is too large for their new body weight. I'm not saying that that's like something that happens every day, but if you're losing a lot of weight very quickly, talk to your doctor about potentially adjusting the medications that you might be on. The next is potentially working with a nutritionist or a dietitian or coach and whatever. I put those in air quotes. Just somebody to make sure you're doing the lifestyle stuff, right? I want to be that person. I know people are going to be taking these drugs whether I exist or not. But I know that the people that I work with, they're lifting weights, they're eating enough protein, they're not losing lean body mass, they're eating as nutritious a diet as possible, which is challenging. Listen, if you've ever taken this drug, you know that it's challenging to eat protein, it's challenging to eat fiber, it's challenging to eat micronutrient-dense foods because you're not really that hungry, right? You're not. Those foods aren't as yummy and they're really satiating, which is why they help, obviously. But I want to be somebody who helps people make the most of this drug by eating enough protein, enough micronutrient dense foods, lifting weights. So please, please, please do those things, right? You have to be taking this drug thinking long-term. We're going to talk about, do you need to take them forever? But think long-term. Think about, oh, I get to turn down the food noise so that I can create good habits for life. Next is please, oh my, I actually put this in all caps, lift weights, OMG, please. Please lift weights. Please lift weights. Please lift weights. You don't need to be a bodybuilder. This isn't about trying to get as absolutely jacked as possible. This is about trying to maintain lean body mass, the kind of muscle that is amazing for metabolic health while you're losing fat. The less you focus on lifestyle while you're on the drug, the more likely you are to gain it all back if you choose to try and get off them at some point, right? The more you focus on lifestyle, the more positive habits that you ingrain, that you get just foundational in your life, the better you'll do if you decide to go off these drugs or take less of them or whatever. So that's a nice segue to our next second to last section, which is, do you need to take them forever? I'm going to be very clear. The effects of the drug stop when you stop taking it. The effects of the drug stop when you stop taking it. You don't get a lasting benefit. But if you use the drug to improve lifestyle and build better habits, those benefits will remain, right? So long as you keep doing them. And, you know, listen, hunger will come back to some degree. So even if you've built amazing habits, natural appetite will come back and it will probably drive an increase in caloric intake and you'll probably gain some weight. The range of weight regained is large. When we see people go cold turkey on these medications, we see some people gain it all back very quickly. We see other people maintain quite a bit of weight loss. We see other people gain no weight back. It's unclear why that is, but I would at least hypothesize it has something to do with the people who built better habits while they were on the drug probably is protective against weight regain. But I want to be clear. Generally, yes. The idea is that you're on these drugs forever as obesity is a chronic disease that requires chronic treatment. I think it's perfectly reasonable, though, to pursue a long-term goal of, hey, can I lose enough weight that gets me into a healthy place, and can I manage and maintain that weight loss, or as much of it as possible, with as little medication as possible? I think that that is a totally fine, like if you're someone who's going on this drug, and you're increasing dosing, and in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, well, I'm going to do this, and as I want to lose the weight that I want to lose, I want to get to a healthy place, and then I'd like to switch my goal to how little of this drug can I take and maintain as much of this weight loss as possible? I think that that's a very reasonable goal to have, right? But I want to be clear, absolutely, as of right now, it's totally normal to think of this as a potentially lifelong drug, which it will be for many people, to help you manage your weight, right? Now, when it comes to taking or getting off this drug, we do see that tapering down or tapering down all the way to, like tapering down to like a micro or maintenance dose is better than cold turkey, right? We see that people, let's call it months afterwards, the ones who tapered off are in a better place than the ones that went cold turkey. I'd say that the people that are in the best position are the people that tapered down to a low dose but are still taking the drug. And so a couple things you can do, you can taper down to a low dose and stay there for a while. You can taper down to no dose and see how that goes. You can also go to taking a dose every few weeks instead of weekly, right? You could take a dose every 2 to 3 weeks. I've had clients do that. I've actually had clients do all of those things. And I've seen pretty darn good results. I've seen people taper down from, you know, 15 milligram tirzepatide all the way down to the introductory dose and maintain all of their weight loss. And then you can say, okay, I'm taking a small amount of this drug and I'm maintaining all of my weight. That's already a wonderful place to be should I need to be there for life. But if I want to experiment maybe with taking my dose every other week and seeing how that goes, can I get to even less medication? I think that that is a fine pursuit. But I want to be very clear, this is not a quick or short-term fix. You know, these drugs should, you know, in my opinion, not be used for losing a couple pounds before summer. This is about, you know, changing your life for the very, very long term. Now, the last thing we will talk about is how to get the drug. And then I'll finish up with 10 things I would remember from this podcast. I'll try and go through this last part quickly. I will say it's not my area of expertise insofar as the discussion of compounding pharmacies, as we'll get into in a second, is a bit hairy. Okay, so how should you get this drug? First and foremost, you should, and I recommend, going through your PCP and through your insurance for safety purposes, right? These are, you will get the FDA-approved version. You'll get FDA-approved quality and potency. You 100% know what you're getting. And yes, insurance may cover all of it or some of it if you qualify, right? Things like BMI, sleep apnea, other markers of metabolic disease can help you qualify for, you know, some insurance coverage. And this podcast, we could do a whole nother podcast on the shortcomings of insurance when it comes to this. It is not my area of expertise, but I will be getting an expert on this to come on and talk about just essentially how insurance, what is insurance's role in this and how they're kind of screwing it up for everyone and just the whole mess of our country's in health insurance policy. So something we could talk about a bit more, right? But I will say there have been shortages and challenges sometimes for patients getting their drugs on time with the right doses when they go through this channel. And that's where compound pharmacies come into play. A compound pharmacy is essentially a pharmacy that sells custom-made medicines, like bespoke medicine, essentially for when there's a shortage or when you need a more custom dosing or mixture of drugs. I don't know enough to speak on the relative safety of compound pharmacies, so I will not. What I will say is there are different classifications of compound pharmacies. There's, you know, whatever the 508B or 508A or whatever that is. They come with different safety profiles, with different protocols, and they can do different things. Obviously, the FDA recommends against it, but that's, you know, because there is some risk, and obviously they want you to go through insurance and through their channels, but still, on average, I would consider this slightly more risky. But talk to your doctor. I mean, this can be something that you discuss with your doctor and you can, you know, do some due diligence to find the least risky route of going through a compound pharmacy. Other way you can get this is through like shady med spa telehealth. If you Google it, you could have Ozempic at your door or Wegovy semaglutide at your door by tomorrow through like some kind of bullshit, if not entirely bullshit, telehealth call with the doctor for 5 minutes, right? To me, because of the lack of oversight in most of these places, whether it's a med spa or telehealth stuff, it's too serious a decision for me to go this route, but I can understand the motivation for it as sometimes there's a lower friction, right? It's easier to get the drug and sometimes it's even cheaper. So I understand the motivation for it. I wouldn't recommend it personally, but I understand the motivation for it. I mean, some experts raise concerns about med spas due to the potential for improper evaluation or lack of comprehensive weight management support and oversight and all of that stuff. I would make sure you check with the sourcing of these drugs and always go with the FDA-approved versions when possible. So let's wrap it up. We're going to crush this, be perfectly in an hour here. Here are the 10 things I would remember from this podcast. Number one, GLP-1 is a hormone produced in the body in response to eating that slows down gastric emptying, increases insulin production, and tells your brain that you've eaten. Number two, these drugs act as such by slowing gastric emptying, telling your brain you're full, and acting on the dopamine opioid system to reduce food reward and ultimately help you eat less, sustain a calorie deficit, and lose weight. Number three, the main side effects of these drugs are GI related, and they get less intense over time and better overall with newer drugs. Number four, these drugs do not cause muscle loss, but if you don't eat protein or lift weights, when you eat very little calories and lose a lot of weight very quickly, you will lose plenty of muscle, and I do not recommend that. Number five, these drugs are not cheating for those who need them. They are leveling the playing field. Number six, if you don't need them, I can't recommend taking them, as it can cause shortages for those who do need them and reinforces thin body standards that can become even more extreme and negatively impact our mental and physical health. Number seven. Work with a coach or in some way somebody to make sure you're actually doing the lifestyle stuff. The drugs are meant to assist, not replace lifestyle and habits. Number eight, the newer drugs combine GLP with other hormones and pathways that are better and will continue to get better. So if you can afford the newer drugs as they come out, they work better. Although they'll likely be very expensive, which is a frustration, especially if you're not going through insurance. What can happen, though, is when a new drug comes out, other drugs will get cheaper. When tirzepatide came out and Zepbound was available, semaglutide became notably cheaper. And when retatrutide or another drug called CagriSema, when those are available, I bet you Zepbound becomes cheaper. And so that might be, again, depending on your financial situation, your physical situation might be a good route to go. Also, I didn't mention this, but tapering down to the cheaper, like if you are in a situation where you don't mind the idea of being on the drug long-term, but it's getting expensive and you've been on Zepbound and it's really expensive, you could go down to semaglutide, which is cheaper. And that might be a way of extending your financial life cycle of these drugs. Number nine, the drugs only work while you're on them. So some people will have to be on them forever, although everyone's different and tapering down dose or frequency seems to be a promising route, at least over quitting cold turkey. And the more you've focused on lifestyle, I suspect the better you'll do. And number 10, ideally go through your PCP for safety quality purposes and avoid shady med spas and telehealth as much as you can that don't have as much quality control or screening. All right. This is a super fun podcast. I'm looking forward to maybe doing another podcast with some of the experts in the field who are doing this research so we can learn a little bit more. I want to be very clear. These drugs are not going anywhere. Whether you think they're bad or whatever, they are here, not only here to stay, but we are in the midst of a Cold War type, tech race to get the best drugs possible. And so let's learn about them. Let's figure out who needs them, who doesn't. Let's help people make the most of them. See if we can use their power for most good. All right, guys, thanks for listening. I'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.